You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
So, oh look, where's your daughter? Oh, there you are. Good to see you. Just by way of introduction, you know, we need to just, begin with the point that people want to be seen, understood, valued, respected. It's just part of who we are. It is, in fact, part of God's design. God designed us to have, you know, a sense of purpose, a sense of, you know, inclusion, to be valued, and those sorts of things. So, you know, even people who seem enormously confident, and even the people who are really shy, right, all of us have this longing for respect, to be valued, appreciated, to think that we have worth and a contribution to make. And the truth is that this desire, when it is inappropriately applied or inappropriately directed, can trip a lot of people up in their Christian lives. A lot of people. And we'll talk about that a little bit more. And just to say something here, what we're talking about here isn't complicated. This is not, I'm a pretty simple guy, okay? All right? I am not, this is not a, you know, some kind of secret. It's not complicated, but it is really challenging, and it presses up against our native selves in a lot of ways. I think it's helpful to think about our cultural context also as a beginning point. And I think about, you know, when we think about our time in history, the time that we're in now, is understanding that there is a historic flow and background to where our culture is today. And so, for example, we have in, you know, what the legacy of rugged individualism in the United States. And this goes back to a somewhat mythical view of America, where Americans were the people that pulled themselves up by their bootstraps. You know, we have heroes. I don't know what they teach in schools today, but when I was in school, there were all these heroes of the pioneer days. The truth is that, you know, none of those people actually did all the things that they are claimed to do alone, okay? The independent, absolutely independent human being is a hero that we've made up that doesn't really fit with reality. But that is part of the background of being an American. We are probably the most hyper-individualistic culture in the history of the world. Okay, when we read the Bible, right, the New Testament, and you read you, right, Y-O-U, we all think me. Not that it matters, but almost every time in the New Testament when that's said, it is plural. It's more like y'all, right, that kind of thing, you, all of you. But we instantly think about ourselves, okay, partly because of the culture that we live in. There's also the legacy of the boomer generation. Full transparency, I was born in 1964. I am the last of the boomers, okay? Well, I mean, there were people that were born in December. I guess they would be the last of the boomers, okay? But, and my mother was the first year of the boomers. I have not personally ever identified, partly because, like every kid, you rebel against your parents' culture to somewhat, but I am technically a boomer. Now, the boomers were people, the generation before, many people have called the greatest generation. These were the men and women, my grandparents' generation, that lived through the Great Depression, right? The recessions and downfalls that we've had in all of your lifetimes are nothing compared to the Great Depression, nothing. They were also the people that rised up and fought World War II. There was something about that generation that just understood, partly because of what they went through and their circumstances, but it was part that they were living for something greater than themselves. Now, their kids, taking all the freedoms that were won for them and the opportunities that came, they went a slightly different path, okay? Now, there were many great things that came out of the boomer generation, all right? The increase in civil rights, the increase of freedom for women. My mother in the 60s couldn't get a mortgage on a house, right, without a man's signature. There's a lot that came that during the boomers' time that was really positive. But they did something else. Something that had always existed. Self-interest, right? Even there were selfish people in the greatest generation, okay? There's always been selfish people. But the boomers, to a great extent, turned it into a virtue. In the night, I can't remember, it was the late 80s or 90s, Self magazine came out. The celebration of self. Okay, what else do we need to say besides that? So that has had an impact on it. You know, we have the whole trajectory of corporate or educational ladder climbing, that your status, your significance is connected to being able to climb the rungs and get greater and greater responsibility, authority, power, influence, and respect comes from that, right? That is part of our culture. We have the rise, in the last couple decades of identity politics and the fight for rights. Now, fighting for rights often has been very good, okay? Martin Luther King and what he did was amazing, okay? Those Americans saying, hey, I shouldn't be marginalized. I really think we should enjoy the same freedoms as other Americans and the same opportunities. That is not wrong. But what has happened since that time, it is like metastasized like a cancer, where every single person, there's this tendency to think about, what am I getting? What are my rights? Where's my respect? Okay, it is just part of the culture that we live in. And then there is the base nature of man. According to the Bible, 1 John chapter 2, right, 15, 16 and following, right? What does John say? He says, do not love the world or the things of the world. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life, all that's in the world, it's not of God, but of the world. Woodsy paraphrase. The boastful pride of life, that deep drive within us that has plagued humans since the beginning of the world, that drove the people to build the Tower of Babel, etc., that the sin of the high hand, that we are great, that we are important, that is just part of who we are. And especially in a broken state that we are, a sinful state that we are in, that need, because we're not taking and drawing life and identity from God, we're trying to find it to ourselves. And ultimately, the outcome is that we do that in comparison to, and sometimes at the expense of other people. Okay? And so the result is, in part, an alienated, unhappy people striving for respect. That's the result in our culture. I could say a lot of other things in our culture, but, you know, it's like the more free that we've gotten, the more wealthy that we've gotten, the more driven for these things that we've gotten, there is almost a identical connection to depression, divorces, all these things. We look at our culture and we just look at the outcome of it, and somebody ought to be saying, why do we think this is the way to go? Why? We keep doing the same thing and we're getting sadder, less happy, more cranky, more alienated as a result. You tracking with me? That's the background. Now, Jesus, before we get to Jesus, we need to talk about the fact that this, of course, impacts church and church culture, okay? We don't come to Christ, show up at the church, and all of a sudden are free from the constraints of our culture. These things have an impact on us. And so we can think about in the church who we honor. Who we honor, right? Do we tend to honor, like, for example, the single mother who is recently divorced, and she's trying to follow Jesus. She's trying to care for her kids. She's working. And in the midst of all that, she is still trying to serve and be generous. Not that much. Or the grandmother who is quietly serving and praying for all her kids, and nobody sees what she's doing, and then slowly but surely her grandkids start coming to Christ. Right? None of you guys ever heard of my grandmother, Winnie. right? And over again, who do we tend, who are the heroes? We think about, you know, these great men and women, generally they're great men because of the way the history was, who did these amazing things. Even in Dwell, who do we tend to really honor? It's the highly gifted, the talented, you know, everybody knows. Like, the truth is, to some extent, in Dwell, like everyone else, there are the rock stars. And we're like, man, people think he's cool. I would like to be like that, you know? Who are our heroes? There's the idea of favoritism or the perception of favoritism. And so we think to ourselves that, man, I wish I had the opportunities that that other guy had. You know, they were discipled or trained or close to that leader, and because of that, these things worked out, right? If I'd had those same opportunities, maybe things would be different for me. And so it's sometimes, you know, I'm just saying even the appearance of favoritism sometimes could cause us real trouble. Yet gifting and capacity. We got a lot of really talented people in this church. Highly gifted people. And sometimes we desire to do ministry that maybe we're actually not gifted by God to do. Okay? I do get to teach publicly. I get to teach in CT periodically. There was a point in time when I was hoping that would become a regular gig. The fact is that the guys that teach regularly here are really, really good. And I'm just kind of okay. You know? I mean, I know I don't suck, but that's not a high bar, right? So sometimes we fix in our mind, I want to do this. And the truth is, to some extent in our church, the people that get, you know, it's just kind of true. It's like, especially leadership gifting and teaching gifting, that ends up being recognized and in some ways more venerated. You know, we could talk, like right now, if I asked you, name gifted teachers, and you go, do, 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 do. And I say, how about people gifted in hospitality? You might know the person in your group. Now, those of us who have been around here a long time, we could start thinking about, well, that person was really good at that, and that person was really good at that. But, you know, we just need to keep that in mind. We have the fact that the church is, to a certain extent, a meritocracy. Okay? Salvation. Acceptance into the body of Christ, all of, you know, our basic foundational standing, that is all in, by God's grace and mercy. Leadership and greater responsibility is to some extent merited, right? There are the qualifications for elders and deacons, for example. The way we operate in our church is people who have been faithful and God has gotten behind and are having success in ministry. Those are the people that we recognize as God raising up as leaders. And so sometimes that happens and we start thinking, what about me? You know, why is that not happening? And then, as I said before, our yet to be perfected nature. We're still fallen. This is a cocktail for a lot of struggle. It just is. You know, that our flesh, our sin nature, that part of us that, you know, is resisting the things of God. All these things, our culture, what's happening around us, our natural dispositions, they all start to come to play. And it just becomes like this internal nightmare. I don't know how, we start having self-doubt. We start having accusations. We feel accused. We start accusing other people. We start accusing God. We start thinking maybe God really isn't behind me because things aren't going the way I hope they would. It could result in being competitive. Other people's success can be a threat. As opposed to being able to look and say, like, you know, the sister here, man, God is working in her life, and look at what's happening and rejoicing because God has worked in her life. We sit back and they're like, oh, man, I really wish I'd had some of that. Nothing I'm saying are not things I've thought. You know, I remember, it's like, you know, hearing about this, these people coming to Christ, I'm like, oh, man, I wish I could have been a part of that. Now, some of that might have been like, wouldn't have been sweet to be used by God that way, but part of it is, how come I'm missing out on the cool stuff? You know, I mean, it's just the way we are. It could be a real trouble. And for many people, this ends up neutralizing them in their Christian lives, okay? Early or later, And I also want to say that even when things seem like they're going well and we're having success in ministry and we actually are, you know, rising in the ladder of Christian ministry, even in that context, what we're talking about can become a real weight on us. It's something that can bring us out. I have watched, I don't know, dozens of people over the years. Some of them that were even shining stars, rising stars once upon a time, who just got completely taken out because things didn't go the way they wanted them to go. And they became resentful and eventually, in some cases, bitter. In some extreme cases, just lost their faith entirely simply because they were requiring recognition and opportunity that they didn't think they got. All right. Jesus has a radical alternative. Let's read. This is in Luke 14. And so Jesus began speaking a parable to the invited guests when he noticed how they had been picking out places of honor at the table. And he said to them, "When you are invited by someone to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for someone more distinguished than you may have been invited by him. And he who invited you both will come and say to you, 'Give your place to this man,' and then in disgrace you proceed to occupy the last place. But when you are invited, go and recline at the last place, the lowest place. So when the one who has invited you comes, he may say to you, 'Friend, move up higher.' Then you will have honor in the sight of all who are able at the table with you. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." And that word exalt means lifted up. If we lift ourselves up, we're going to be humbled. But if we humble ourselves, God will lift us up. Okay, so that's our passage. Let's think about the setting. Let's think about how completely insane this is. I don't know if you guys have noticed this. Okay, he is at a wedding feast, seeing people behaving in a certain way, and he gives a parable that is exactly what they're doing. All right? I mean, it's like they're fighting, they're juxtaposing for position, they're doing this thing, and Jesus goes, "You know, you really shouldn't do this." But that's the setting, is that in, you know, it's not true in our it's not true in our context that much. There's not a lot of places that you go to where you know, places of honor are set up. It happens sometimes. But they, you know, for them, there was a hierarchy, and the closer you were to the host, the more valuable, respected, and important you were. And so that's what they're doing. Okay? What he noticed is that they were seeking recognition and honor, and in comparison to the other invited guests. How do I stand? How, you know, what's my value to, you know, not only my value to the host and in the context that we're in, but how do I compare to the other people who have been invited? Okay? They were trying to look better than others and in comparison to other people, the other invited guests. And what he says, when you've been invited by someone to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor. Okay? Let me say it again. Don't try to take first place, first position. We're being told it's a clear decision that we make not to seek honor or top position. We choose. And it is, in the context, I think, in our culture and in a context here, it is a choice to make a stand and to be different than our broader society, to stand against the norm. So we don't do it. And why not? Don't compete for honor, recognition, or first position. Did you hear that? Just don't do it. Easy enough? No, it's not. Why not? Someone more distinguished than you may have been invited by him. Someone who actually is more valuable or more honored might have been invited. And that's something that is hard to take, but that is what the context that's saying is. Somebody actually who deserves more to be in that place might show up. And then what happens? The host comes in and says, "Give your place to this man." The host comes in and steps you down, and then potentially you end up in last position. You are trying to get close to him, and the result is you are far away in the place of least honor. Again, we don't do this much in our culture, but there are a few settings. My youngest daughter, Katya, is getting married August 6th. Yes, August 6th. Yeah, it's my second one in 8 months. I have her daughters. Home equity lines of credit are cool.
No.
She's getting married in August. At weddings, there is a hierarchy of where people sit. Right? So when you walk into most traditional American weddings, up front is reserved for family and relatives. And, you know, there's the place for the groom, you know, the father and mother of the bride, the father and mother of the groom, you know, et cetera. Those are the place. And some guy who shows up, you know, and just decides that they want to look like this has actually never happened. But they're like, I want to look like I'm important to Woodsy. Never going to happen. They come up and they sit where like my mom is supposed to sit. Right, and if the whole room is filled by this time, because right, everyone's supposed to be seated at this time, and they walk their grandparents down, all that kind of stuff. Well, then you know I'm like, dude, get back, and he ends up in the balcony and embarrassed. That's the closest thing in our culture. We don't have wedding feasts like this, but you could end up in last position. And he just says you could end in disgrace. And let's just make it simple: self-promotion. The moral of this part of the story is self-promotion can end in disgrace. But he continues. He says, but when you are invited, and I think we should take a moment to think about who has invited us. Okay? Who has invited us to the great wedding feast of the Lamb, which is, you know, in the next life? Who has invited us into, for lack of a better way to put it, the party that God is putting on in the world? Who? It's God. He invited us. And he says, so when you are invited, go, right? I already talked about this. Each of us has been chosen. We've been invited. This is a good passage. 2 Peter 1:10. He says, therefore, brethren, be all the more diligent to make certain about his calling and choosing of you. His calling and choosing of you. I think it's helpful to actually think about this for a minute. God, each one of you, God has called into his great salvation. He called you into it. God called you into a relationship with him. God has called you, each of you, to participate in his great work in the world. He chose you. He chose you to be his son or his daughter, an heir. He chose you to fulfill the purposes in this world that he has for you, to play the part God wants it. He chose you to do that. And so when we're thinking about this whole picture, it's keeping in mind that God Almighty, who proved his great, great love for us on the cross, when he died for us and brought us into a relationship with him as his sons and daughters, this is the God who has invited us into this party. And what does he say to those of us that have been invited? Go and recline at the last place. Intentionally choose to seek out the lesser place. I'll say it again. We choose to seek out the lesser place. What does this passage not say? What does it not say? There's no unless clause. Right? Unless you are being overlooked, which, by the way, happens. Unless people are keeping you down, or you think they are. Unless you actually do deserve the best place, there's no unless cause. Even if you are being currently overlooked by the people around you, even if some people might be making it harder for you to advance. Even if maybe the person that got the opportunity doesn't deserve it as much as you. Even if those things are true, he says, go and seek out the lesser place. And so we do that, why? So that when the one who has invited us come, and we just need to understand that the person who has the final say is the host. God has the final say. So here is something that's a little bit corny, but I think is sort of helpful. And that is that we should let God be our public relations manager. Instead of the tyranny and the weight of having to make sure that we're understood and that we're valued and that people see the contributions that we really make and that we really are spiritual, all those things, we just put that in God's hands and say, I'll trust you to give the testimony of my life. I'll trust you if you think I should, you know, be in a place. I'll trust you to promote me. I'll trust you to open up opportunities to me. I can, you know, that's what a PR manager does. And we're basically just deciding that we'll let God take the lead on that. Okay. Now, sure, that can be challenging. I said this is simple. There's nothing cosmically crazy about this, but it can be challenging. We'll talk about that in a minute. And he says that he comes, he says, friend, move up higher, and then you will have honor in the sight of all who are at the table with you. You will be honored by God, and people will see it. Right? It's not that there's no audience besides God, right? But it's God who decides when and where he honors his people and before who he does it. Ultimately, at the end of history, I am just telling you, at the end of history, the people that are honored, the people who God really rejoices in, the people who are like, man, this guy lived, you know, totally all in for us, for God. They are people that most of us, I think, will have never heard of. Okay? And there's going to be this crazy celebration. You know, I have this joke. Like the people I work with in the Ivory Coast, for example, I hope I get to be their butler. Because I know, I just know he's going to honor them more than he honors me. I just know it's true. But that's going to happen. And then he finally says, everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. He who lifts himself up, that's what it means. If we lift ourselves up, we are going to be humbled. God is going to lower. It just, I want you to think about it. If you're self-promoting, God may end up forcing you lower. But those who are lower, let themselves God, he will raise up. Okay, another passage, 1 Peter 5:6. He says, therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you at the proper time. We humble ourselves before him, and we entrust our exaltation, our being lifted up in this life and the next, we entrust it to him. And the way it reads is that he may exalt you. The reality is that if we are self-promoting, if we are exalting ourselves, it makes it, how does God exalt us when we're doing it ourselves? It can't happen. Another passage, James 4:6, he says, therefore it says, God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Now, opposed here doesn't mean like, okay, Christmas time at my house, my daughters have historically come home and spent several days for us. They often want to, my wife and daughters like to watch films. The choices that my wife and daughters make are not always exactly what I want. I don't really want to watch Pride and Prejudice again. I mean, it's a good movie, but like it's like a tradition. And it's like, you know, and so I end up going in the basement and like, you know, hammering things or something, you know. Or like, you know, I did one year, I had my headphones in watching my team, soccer team I support, playing while they're like, you know, crying. I mean, what is it about women who like know they intentionally pick out movies knowing it will make them cry. I can't think of a single dude. It's like, dude, hey, you up for a good cry? Yeah, let's go do this. I don't, that my saying I'd rather not, that is not the kind of opposition that we're talking about here. You know, I'm opposed. You know, it's like, I'm really not into it. That's not the idea. It's not that God is just kind of, I wish you weren't. The word opposed is a military term, and the picture is like the Roman legions, shields up, sword out, standing ready to take on the enemy. So when it says that God is opposed to the proud, it is God, shield up, sword out, in opposition to our pride and the people who are prideful. Okay, it's not a gentle word. But then it says he gives grace. He gives what is undeserved. Right? He gets behind. He gives strength. He gives power. He works through the humble. He supports and is with the humble. And so pride is a massive deal. I think we've hammered that home. And we need to understand that other people's advancement is no threat to us. If God is the audience, and God is the ultimate director of our lives, and he is the one who gives, is really the one who's going to pass judgment on our lives, even if we are overlooked in this life to some extent, whatever, other people's success, our comparison to other people, isn't a threat because it's what God thinks that matters. There's no zero-sum game. Okay? Any mathematicians? You know, anyway, zero-sum game. Real simple. Increase here requires a decrease there. That is how the Soviet Union viewed the world. Anything good that happened to the West, especially America, automatically was viewed as a negative for them. Okay? We sometimes view it that way. We get competitive. The fact is that in God's economy, it is possible for multiple people to be raised up simultaneously without any impact on anybody else or anybody else's standing. All right. This, I think, can result in freedom. Okay? So let's think about. Think about what I've said. This might not work. If you are terrible, this won't work. But what could this provide freedom from? That's a question. What could it provide freedom from? Anxiety. Jealousy. Yes, the people pleasing. Oh, who said that? Yes. Because, you know, we're compared to other people. Sometimes we talk crap about them, you know, because it will make us look better. Slander. Yeah. Legalism. Okay. Especially legalism in terms of our comparison to other people. Absolutely. Huh? Striving, right? That kind of frenetic need to accomplish so I'm recognized and I'm valued. I think that's true.
Bitterness.
Bitterness? Yep, because we're not getting what we want, at least.
Freedom from identifying our self-identity.
Yeah, I think so. It also provides freedom from thinking that we're all that because we get opportunities. I must be, it's like, well, I've been sent as a missionary. I must be good with God, which was true of my life. You know, we can start to think that because our okayness with God is based on our success, not just the fact that we're not successful. Both things can happen. I threw out a couple more, and it's like you guys said it, the tyranny of comparison. The need for recognition, the fear of being overlooked, the plague of competition, there's all kinds of things this can give us freedom from. It also gives us freedom for things. Anybody have some ideas about what we might be more free for?
Freedom to help other people with their ministry, even though we won't get recognized.
Oh, what are you saying? I make them look good? It works against my purpose. Yes, that's good. Absolutely. Absolutely. Any other thoughts? Yeah. Yeah, you look like, it's like, yes, imagine being grateful for what God gives us instead of chronically unhappy about what we don't have. What a crazy idea, you know? Oh, my name's written in the book of life, which according to Jesus is the most important thing. Yeah, I know my name's written in the book of life, but, you know, I didn't get to teach cell group this week, you know? It's like, you know, the joke, this would all be good, God, if you would just, anyway. I think that part of it is we're free to take our lead from God in a more real way. This making these decisions to purposefully allow God to be our PR manager, to purposely take the lower seat, it makes it easier to actually follow God's lead because that internal strife. You know, we all have mixed motives, right? All of us. But that sense that like, oh, am I doing this because I want it or am I doing it because God wants it? And then you say, what does taking the lower seat look like? And many times in my life, it cleans up that mess. I think the joy, like you guys, the actual ability to take joy in other people's success, you know, to rejoice when God is shaping a man or woman into the person they want him to be and starts to use that and to just be able to honor God and take joy over it, I think more freely to love and more free to serve. I think this is also energizing, okay? And I'm just going to put it this way. First of all, knowing that I'm choosing God's path, the path of humility, knowing I'm choosing humility, knowing that I'm seeking to honor God and looking to God for my okayness. I don't even know if that's a real word. Okayness. I just said it. I'm an American. It must be good. There's something freeing and energizing about that. That like it, when we're in the middle of, you know, kind of wrestling with our thoughts and our desires, and then we choose the path that God has called us to do in humility, there's something about that is freeing and energizing. It gives us more energy to serve people. I think, like you said, a deep sense of gratitude to God, the sense of the privilege to know that He is using me in other people's lives. I think it's energizing. I think it also is a path to increased fruitfulness. And the way I say it is that the freedom and energy to invest in true kingdom work, that because I'm making decisions that push me away from my own agenda, I am more energized to do the things that God has really called me to do. And we're told, He says that God gives grace, He supports the humble. And so if God is supporting and empowering and He gets behind the humble, then taking this path, we can have confidence that He will help us become fruitful, okay? And God raises up the humble for moderate responsibility, okay? Look, it is true that many times the prideful get in positions of responsibility. Of course that's true. What we see over time is God either beats that out of them. That's kind of what it's like. It's like sledgehammers. He either beats that out of them or they end up getting taken out. Okay, it happens. And then finally, the picture of being honored and rewarded by God Himself. The only voice that matters, the only truly matters is God. And we think about the parable of the talents and the opportunity to have God say to you, well done, good and faithful servant. Enter into the joy of your master. There is a privilege there that is beyond measuring. You know, in this life we struggle, we get confused, but I am telling you at that moment, as we are standing at the end of history and God Almighty Himself looks at you with joy because of the life you led, every sacrifice, every sense of humiliation you might have felt, whatever, all of that at that moment will be like, oh, it was so worth it, so worth it. And, you know, He honors sometimes in this life, but ultimately in the next, and He rewards the faithful. He does. The alternative is this, Matthew 6:2. So when you give to the poor, do not sound a trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, so that they may be honored by men. Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. So these are people that clearly wanted the praise and accolades of humans. And so they took strides to do it, and they were honored. And what Jesus says, that's all they're going to get. We used to have a joke. You know, imagine someone boasting about the ministry they were doing. Never happens. But we'd have a joke, you know, back in the early days. Some guy would be like, dude, man, I had, you know, it wasn't just like God, you know, some humble way. I had this great talk with this guy, but he'd be like, man, I got to do this, and I did this thing, and I did this thing, and you could just sense there was like this boastfulness about it. And I'd look at him, and I'd go, how'd I feel? Feel good? That's all you're going to get. And they're like, what? I go, and I take him to this passage. Oh! You know, there's a point in that is that we honor, if our goal is honor from people, and we achieve honor from people, or in comparison to other people, then what at the end of history before the Bema seat, that those things are going to be burned up. That's what he's saying. And so we can, and we live in a culture that thrives on self-honor. All right, let's think about some applications here. And again, there's nothing overly complicated about that. I said this can be challenging, but God will help you. Now, in full disclosure, I made a very conscious decision after I was a missionary in Russia, and my wife and I were recalled in part because I was not the husband I should be, and other things that were going on. And so I went from being, you know, a fairly public figure, and, you know, back, it's a little different, like a lot of, today, a lot of you don't even know who our missionaries are, but this was like, we were, it was like a fairly public figure. Came back in disgrace, and, you know, that was the hardest thing up that point I'd ever gone through. I was aware, God made me aware, of a drive in my life that was basically, for lack of a better word, self-promoting. Okay? It wasn't my only motivation. I had other motivations. I wasn't a complete dirtbag, you know. But, you know, it was clear that the idea, like the striving for certain things was clear, and I made a decision that I was not going to do that anymore, which I've mostly done. But allowing and just saying, God, I'm going, you know, and I had to ask him. It wasn't like all of a sudden I said, God, I want to do this, and it was like I was free. Oh, heck no. It was like struggle after struggle and feelings of disappointment and missing out and all those things. I felt those things, but I'm like, God, I'm just going to entrust you. I'm going to entrust you. And ask him for help. And so we make the decision, but the reality is there's a lot going on in our heart, and we need to engage with God so he helps free us of those things. Okay? It can be challenging, but God helped you. And to some extent, he's helped me. The truth is, since that time, you know, a couple years after being recalled, we started leading home churches again. After doing some work in the secular world, you know, I was doing some coaching and with small groups, and then I got asked, and this was a tough one. I got asked, I was about to pull the trigger on a six-figure job, and this is, you know, quite a few years ago, and I'm like, you know, I was going to make good money, and then I was asked if I would consider taking a three-day-a-week job, making 30 grand a year, with no promise of anything else. And I'm like, that really does sound like the lower seat. But I did it. And when I became a sphere leader, I'm like, are you sure? Are you sure? Are you sure? I wanted to do the job, but I wasn't advocating for it. My point is that God has continually responded. I just let him do it. It went slower than I want. There's things that, whatever. All right, enough of that. This could be very helpful in making hard decisions. when we have this dilemma in our mind, like, you know, which direction should I go? Sometimes simply asking, what does it look like to take the lower seat? I have a similar thing that I, in certain situations where I say somewhat differently, what path would honor God? What does it look like to take the lower seat? A year and a half ago, I was presented with an opportunity. Like I told you guys, I've been a sphere leader. And this opportunity came up that was going to include the raising up of Chris Risley as a sphere leader. I've been working with her for several years, and allow me to do more work in missions, which I have a real passion for. And I'm on the face of it, that all seems really good. But the truth was that it was going to require, at the end of this year, I will no longer be a sphere leader. And there were certain, if you're not in our church, you know, no one knows what a sphere leader is. It's like totally us. I oversee a family of home groups of about 500 people. That's what I do. I coach them and so forth. I was going to have to give that up. And I, you know, I had some turmoil over it because there were things, there's part of me like, why can't I do that and this? That seems cool, you know. There's lots of things about being a sphere leader that I've really enjoyed. But in my wrestling with God over this decision, I just simply said, all right, what does it look like to take the lower seat here? The lower seat that could result in the raising up of Chris Lisley, a really godly woman in our church, you know, that I had the privilege of partnering and working with, you know, to see, you know, a stronger conduit between student and adult ministry. What was the best interest of the church? You know, what was the best interest of what we're doing in missions as opposed to what I wanted to do? And when I simply did that, it helped to it took all the fog away. And it was like, this is of course the right thing to do. When I made the decision, okay, it could be helpful in that. You know, all kinds of things in ministry. Like, you know, you were saying earlier, getting behind and supporting other people, to see other people be successful. You know, to not worry that I'm not getting the opportunities to, you know, be the teacher or whatever it is. Yes, we want those things. God has clearly said those who want to seek to be overseers, that's an honorable or a noble ambition. There is noble ambition. But in this context, it's like according to God's plan. And we're allowing him to do it. And so it's the idea of supporting other ministries. It's the idea of taking the back seat in a particular situation because somebody's more gifted or has more expertise in that area. I think in evangelism and engaging our culture. Okay? Clive's been talking about it. It's the reality of our world. We are not as popular as we once were. Now, those of you guys who have been in Dwell / Xenos for as long as I have, look, when I was at Ohio State in 1983, it's when I came to Christ, a thing called The Lantern, which is a newspaper that OSU used to make. Do they still make it? Okay. Used to run articles about how we were a cult. So partly for me, the cult accusation is this what I've lived with my whole life. I'm like, yeah, they've been saying that since the first year I was a Christian. Okay, but we are not as popular. But there's a tendency within us to want to look good in front of people, to want to stand out, to be respected. And part of the application of taking the lower seat to in evangelism in our culture is to just be okay with the less than privileged position that we have. It also is, how can I get behind what other people are doing, right? So taking a lower seat like might be, let's get behind some other people that are serving the community and help them as opposed to having to be something we do. And I think broadly, and again, we try real hard not to be political in this church. Caring less about how we're viewed and being willing to just kind of bow to secondary and tertiary things. The primary thing is the gospel and people coming to know Jesus. There are other things that matter, but they're not as important, and to park those things. And I've said this multiple times. I don't care what political party you're in, but here's the fact. The first thing someone learns about you should not be that. okay? And just to be clear, and again, lots of people in our church are Republicans. This is not a slam on Republicans. Most non-Christians think that there is a marriage between the Republican Party and evangelical Christianity, and that's not helpful. Partly, I think, taking the lower seat as people in the church is to do everything we can to not fight about things that are less important. Anyway, in our jobs or classrooms, right? Most of you have or will work in an environment where success is connected to your ability to outdo other people. How many of you applied for a new job in the last year or two? You guys prayed for it, right? You're praying that God would give you that job. And disappointment when it didn't happen, right? I mean, it sucks. I've been in that position. Finding a job is terrible. Ever cross your mind that somebody else is praying for that job too? It's like we just think. It's like me and God, and why are you not doing this? And then maybe we say, well, like, that must have been not the one you wanted for me. We try to say that as we walk out in discouragement. It's like we're not the only people, right? And look, if you apply for a promotion in your company and there's only one place, by definition, if you get it, it's at the expense of other people who also were hoping for that promotion and all those things. It's just a perspective. And in our workplace, to be able to be great employees, to love and care the people we work for, and not fret so much about whether or not we're recognized. And this is true, I guess, unless you go to a small college, probably how you're looked. But in the classroom, it's often like this as well. In friendships, okay? How many of you have been friends with somebody, even best friends with somebody, who started getting advanced more quickly than you are in ministry, right? And you're thinking to yourself, don't people know how important I am and how crazy she is or he is? And if I wasn't there, they would have fell apart a year ago. You never have those thoughts, do you? I think it matters. I have had the unique opportunity and privilege on a number of times in my life, including now, to be really good friends of people that are very talented, very talented. And it's just, and sometimes, you know, I'm with this guy, like, I'll just, like, Jim Leffel. Okay, Jim Leffel. We're basically best friends. A lot of the trips he takes to Africa, I'm with him on, yada, yada, yada. And, you know, and frequently it's like, and Jim did this, and Jim did this, and Jim did this, and this little feeling inside goes, you know, I was there too. And, you know, I taught half that material when we were there. The ability to be a second for a person is an enormously valuable gift. You know, and again, because it's God at the end of history who evaluates our life, that, you know, it's like if we have the opportunity to help keep a person of maybe more gifting and influence us, if our role is partly to help keep them in the fight and directed and bringing to the table the things God has designed them to bring, that is a valuable contribution we can make. All right, and this in family, and we're just going to go on. All right, I'm going to just read this passage because I just realized, because I'm woodsy, I have 4 minutes left. Here's a perspectival safeguard. I'm the guy, I actually taught a class on the, I wanted to call it the ass-kicking sayings of Jesus, but they wouldn't let me, so it was called When Jesus Brings Out the Hammer. And this is one of them. He says, which of you, having a slave plowing or tending sheep, will say to him when he has come in from the field, come immediately and sit down? But will he not say, prepare something for me to eat and properly clothe yourself and serve me while I eat and drink, and afterwards you may eat and drink? He does not thank the slave because he did the things which were commanded, does he? So you, too, when you do all the things that are commanded, you say, we are unworthy slaves. We've only done as we ought have done. So super quickly, common in the first century, People had slaves, even Jews. Sometimes it's because of debt, whatever, but they had them. And he says, which one, you know, the slave's out working in the field, and would the guy ever say, hey, dude, man, you look tired. Let me feed you and serve you. And their response would be, see, that would never happen. No, that would never happen. And what he would say is, prepare something for me to eat, clean the dirt off your feet, come on in here and serve me. And afterwards, you can meet your own needs. And they would all say, yep, that's completely normal. And so he doesn't thank the slave, does he? And they're like, nope, that would never happen. That would be odd. See, he's leading them. And he says, so too, when you've done all the things that are commanded to you, okay, if every day, all the time, in every situation, in every way possible, you perfectly do every single thing God commanded you to do, right? You're dreaming spiritually, okay? Everything, right? Even if you do every single thing that God asks you to do, you are the greatest example of an obedient Christian in the history of the world, okay? Even if that's all true, what does he say? You are an unworthy slave, and you've only done that which you ought to have done. At our best, we are unworthy recipients of amazing mercy, and we're just doing what God asks us to do. There is no such thing as a Christian who has gone above and beyond what God asked him to do. Never. Never. And so, bottom line, the opportunity to serve God is nothing we deserve.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.